Hello, I'm Matt Baume, and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast search for the entertainment that changed the lives of queer people. On this week's episode, Hercules is a Twink, Spice World, and the Drag Queen of Corn. My guest this week is one of the busiest people I've ever interviewed. Rue George Warren is an educator, an ecologist, a singer, an activist, a performance artist, and that's not even half of the jobs you might find him doing on any particular day. Rue was raised with a healthy respect for skepticism and rebellion, and after venturing away from the town where he grew up, he found his calling close to home, now focusing on issues like food sovereignty and language revitalization for the Catawba Nation. We'll have that conversation in a minute, and hey, don't forget to head over to mattbaume.com to subscribe to my cute little newsletter. This week, I shared a bunch of my favorite Betty White performances. Also, take a look at my YouTube channel, where I post stories about TV and film history. I've got a Golden Girls video in the works over there. And head over to my Patreon to support The Sewers of Paris and watch hours of bonus videos about queer pop culture. I just posted a roundup on Patreon of the most downloaded episodes of Sewers of Paris in 2021, along with my most watched YouTube videos. Now, here's my conversation with Rue. Well, this week I'm speaking to Rue George Warren, a consultant and artist in the Catawba Nation. Thanks so much for joining me.
Tanake, Matt. So nice to meet here.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
Well, when I was a kid, it was all like very basic kid stuff. Very in love with a lot of the Disney properties, of course. rarely empathizing with the male leads, except for Hercules. But only in the first part when he's a twink. But later on when he becomes a himbo, I like completely move my focus over to Meg, right?
Right.
so yeah, that of course Pocahontas, which is like kind of funny now, because a lot of the things I talk about is like representation of Indigenous peoples and Catawbas and things like that. But I can't think of like any explicitly queer. Well, that's not true. I remember, like, definitely lots of queer experiences, like, you know, empathizing with Bette Midler in Hocus Pocus, and when we were playing it on the schoolyard, you know, being like, no, I'm playing Bette Midler. And one time I even got my mom's stick-on bright red acrylic nails, because, you know, it's not just about the acting, it's also about the costume.
The look.
And so I did, you know, the performance of a lifetime. And then we were standing in line to go back inside. And the teacher was like, oh, why are you wearing those? Boys don't wear those. And like pops them off. But there was that. And then the first time, though, that there was the like any kind of like sexualized or like specifically gay male experience was definitely Spice World. And my older sister and my two older cousins, who are all women, they were watching it, and I like snuck in and was watching it with them. And then there's just the scene where they're like getting ready for a show, and all the male backup dancers turn around, and they all have like those mesh cutout, you know, like butt windows.
Sure, yeah, like chaps.
Sort of. Have you seen this important cinema?
You know, I've dozens and dozens of times when it was fresh, but it's been many years since I actually went back.
Yeah, it's kind of like chaps, but it's like a unique piece of clothing I haven't seen since then.
Okay.
But I remember seeing it and being like, oh, and then that was also the moment that everyone in the room was like, oh, this might not be appropriate for his age, because I think it was like 8 or 9, or it was when it first came out.
Okay. So it sounds like it's a lot of stuff that's sort of like pre-awareness of gay aesthetic, and yet somehow you were drawn to it without being told to.
Yeah, well, because everything that people were telling me to do because I was a boy was so fucking boring. Like, like I remember I was very lucky because I came, like my grandfather was the first non-white person in South Carolina to play on a college football team. And he was even like recruited, just so ironically, by the Washington team back when they had a slur for a name. He ended up busting up his knee, and he was a citizen of Catawba Nation. He was our assistant chief for a long time. But he busted up his knee and never ended up playing for him. So you'd think that there would be a lot of pressure for me to be a sports person, because I was also the first boy born on both sides of the family, and on his side in two generations, because he only had daughters. But he was like very, very supportive of everything that I liked to do. They did try like once or twice to get me into sports, because I guess that's what you were expected to do. And I just remember one time it was like softball, and they put me in the outfield, I guess is what it's called. and they like someone hit the ball. It like kind of came in my general direction, but I was like building a sandcastle, and they were like, "Get the ball, get the ball!" Mm-hmm. And I was like, "Why? Why?" Right. And they're like, "Run!" And I was like, "I don't want to."
That was so much my experience as well. Like, well, boys have to play sports, so
yeah.
I guess this is how it. I guess this is this sports. Am I doing sports?
You know, and I recently, and it's funny because I recently went to my really good friend's softball team, like intramural softball team match. And at first I was like, oh, this is going to be bad. But I loved it. Like they were so loving and supportive and it was fun and all that. And then the second time I went to their game, right next to it was like a little league game. Mm-hmm. And I immediately remembered why I found sports unappealing, which is that everyone's yelling at you. Like the parents on the sideline, they're yelling. The coach is yelling. Like there's no joy. And I was like, this seems, I guess as a kid, I was just like, that is like not at all something I'm interested in spending time on.
Yeah. You know, looking back, because I experienced that as well. I have to think, like, if I'm putting myself in that adult's perspective there, that they thought it was encouraging, but it just felt like, it just felt so, this is my experience, so wrong for me to want to pursue these things. Like, it was just something so joyless for me versus, like you were saying, building the sandcastle.
Yeah, where it's like, someone can come along and say, that's stupid, and I could be like, I don't care. It's mm-hmm. my sandcastle. Mm-hmm. Whereas with sports, there was always this metric of success, right? Like, you win or you don't. And mm-hmm. that just felt like really stifling.
Yeah. So were you, tell me a little about where you're growing up. I mean, you mentioned that your grandfather was the first member of the Catawba Nation to play football. Was it professionally or to be signed to a team? Is that correct?
He was the first citizen of Catawba Nation, to my knowledge, who played collegiate football. Mm-hmm. He played for Clemson University, but he was also the first non-white person in South Carolina mm-hmm. to play for collegiate football. And this was in 1953, like pre-Brown v. Board of Education. Mm-hmm. And I am, like, if you see me, I am white and blue-eyed and, like, you would never... You know, I've never experienced anti-Native racism directed at me, but he is definitely like, he was definitely visibly not white. And so, you know, my aunt was actually just telling me that she was looking back through paper records of how the newspapers were talking about him when he was in high school, because he was kind of an all-star in my hometown, and then how he was in college. And they just used so many like horrible tropes. Mm. Like one nickname they gave him was the disappearing Indian, which is, you know, part of this trope in the United States that tribes are just going to disappear. So we don't need to worry about them. Mm. And it's just like, what is this? But yeah, so he did that, but I grew up, I was born in Atlanta while my mom was in law school. My tribe was in the midst of this like 25 year long litigation to try and regain our federal status. And so she was asked to come back up to the tribe and help with that. And so for a couple of years, my dad and I would every weekend drive from Atlanta up to Rock Hill, which is like 6 to 8 hours, I guess. Hmm. And then eventually we all moved up to Rock Hill. And so that's where I grew up, was in Rock Hill, which is the city that surrounds the Catawba Reservation. I grew up off the reservation, but my mom worked for the tribe. My granddad, like I said, was the assistant chief. My aunt worked for the tribe. So I got to go there like all summer and like after school and all that good stuff.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I was going to ask like to what extent Native culture was a part of your upbringing, but it sounds like it was quite present.
Yeah. And it's, well, and now I live on our reservation. I'm calling you from our Green Earth Reservation. We have two discontiguous reservations. But it wasn't present in the way that I think folks might expect from like media representations of Native folks. Like I wasn't super involved in ceremony really at all. Very little involved in drumming. I did some of the arts like pottery and basketry, but was never like, super into that. I found the language the most interesting, but it was more being very much rooted in the Catawba community. So, you know, when I left to go off to college and then to DC and elsewhere, and when I came back, I was a little bit nervous. Like, you know, are people going to remember me? Are they going to accept me? Like, are they going to let me do the work that I think I should be doing? And it was awesome, because it was immediately like all these old people like walked up and they said, Rue, like I haven't seen you since you were knee high to a grasshopper, blah, 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 blah. So it's really more the sense of community that I think I grew up with. Plus our culture, I mean, different than a lot of other tribes. We've been dealing with settlers since the early 1600s. And so we've lost a lot of our cultural heritage. And so that's actually a lot of what my work is and what we're doing in Catawba Nation now, is taking those pieces that our ancestors gave us and trying to reweave them into something that we can give all to the next generation so that they have something more than us.
Yeah. Can you tell me about, like, how aware were you, like, as a kid, like, that this was something, you know, the cultural preservation, this stuff that you're doing now, like, was that something that you were aware of that was a challenge and something that had to be done intentionally and mindfully to prevent the culture from disappearing?
Oh, absolutely. My aunt has ran our cultural center since I was, well, since before I was born, actually. So, you know, I was very much aware that that was labor that needed to be done, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas with the United States culture, it's kind of in a self-perpetuating situation, a cancerous situation even. And so, yeah, it was definitely something I was aware of. But then I was also, like, very conflicted as a kid about being Catawba, because every time I mentioned being Catawba, I would get responses like, no, you aren't, you don't look like it, or do you live in a teepee? And the United States, we really, really, really are very focused on a kind of a binary racial conversation. And so I was like, my thought as a young person was like, well, I don't look Native. I've never had to struggle because someone, like, pointed at me and said, ooh, Catawba. And so, like, what right do I have to claim to be Catawba? But of course, I've learned now that part of colonialism is trying to get people to renounce their citizenship in tribal nations and assimilate into the United States. So a lot of what I talk about with our community is the fact that we're a multiracial tribal nation. We have citizens who get racialized as Black. We have citizens who are racialized as Hispanic. We have all sorts of folks. And so the idea of what a Catawba looks like is, you know, really outdated. And a lot of that is due to media.
Did you have any sort of queer representation or role models or anything like that as you were growing up?
Yeah, I was just thinking about this the other day. I was really lucky because I did have at least three relatives that were all out and living with partners, and they were all Catawba. We weren't really close. Like, I don't have lots of memories of spending time with them, but I remember them being a part of the community, being respected, being living a life. And so it was, I guess it was always in my imagination, like, in the realm of possibility that this was something that was a lifestyle that you could live. But I also was growing up, my parents, very chill, very cool, awesome people. But I went to a very, very conservative Christian school from preschool until I graduated my senior year. And in that context, it was iterated many times that it was not okay to be gay.
Was there a point when you started to think, like, oh, gay, that might be a word for, like, another group that I might belong to?
Yeah, well, I'm still uncomfortable with the term gay to describe myself. I, like, really am more into queer. And I think that it's because even before what I perceived as my difference had any, like, sexuality in it, there was still difference, right? There was still a queerness, which I think a lot of us probably have experiences of. And I was really lucky because my parents, like I said, were both, you know, hashtag woke for the time. And my mother in particular is very argumentative and anti-authoritarian. She's my Catawba parent. And so basically we would, you know, learn these things in school, and then we would come home and she'd be like, so what did you learn today? We'd be like, blah, blah, blah. We learned gays are going to hell, blah, blah, blah. And she'd be like, oh, now do we believe it just because they say it's true? And the correct answer is no, you have to question everything. So,
wow.
So I had a very secure sense that, like, just because someone else said that I should be doing something or I shouldn't be doing something, that doesn't necessarily mean one thing or the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, boy, that's really fortunate to have that kind of skepticism, just to have the permission for it.
Yeah, it did also turn into some, like, intense obstinacy and anti, like, reflexive anti-authoritarianism. So now it's, like, very difficult for me to work for people that I don't, like, immensely respect, and particularly to work for men. Like, I can't. I, like, immediately get into power struggles, and then I'm like, what am I doing? What is happening?
Like, sure. I mean, honestly, like, it sounds like better to have the comfort to challenge things than just be like, oh, I got to go along with everything.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So I think, you know, when I first heard the term queer, I mean, I think that I was so uncomfortable with the term gay, because that was the, I think an older generation maybe had queer lobbied at them a lot more, whereas gay was the slur when I was a kid, right? Like that, oh, you're gay, that's gay, he's gay, she's gay. Like, it's like, whoa, okay. But no one really used the term queer or the F slur at all when I was a kid. And so I think I just had a lot more like emotional like reticence about the term gay. But when I heard the term queer, I was like, oh yeah, hell yeah, this makes so much sense. Because it's also, I don't know, it's kind of flirtatious as a term, because it's identifying yourself, but also at the same time refusing identification. Like, what can you say about a queer person, right? It could be literally anything or anyone who exhibits any kind of behavior. So I think that's what I like about it, is that it actually doesn't reveal much at all.
Yeah. And, you know, that's another thing that I've heard from people like on the show, that they appreciate something like the everybody-ness or the everythingness of queer that can mean so much. And also that it's a relatively new phenomenon, because when you go looking for characters like that in media, you know, there's just so many expectations, like this is what gay is and this is what lesbian is. And bisexuals don't exist, because in media, like bisexuals, just for some reason, there's just this absence of them.
They're just a liminal sexuality, according to the earlier media.
Yeah, yeah. And so I forget where I was going with that, but oh, yeah. Okay. So there's just a lot of pressure around what gay is supposed to look like, and very little exposure to characters who are queer and they're fine with just being queer.
Yeah. Right. And weird. Right. Though I think those were always the characters that spoke the most to me, was like the weird character who had a special power. You know, I'm trying to think of a good example, but particularly the ones who were unbothered by their weirdness. I've seen this a lot more in newer cartoons. Like, I recently watched, at the beginning of COVID, I think it was She-Ra, and there's a character in it who is just, like, so weird, and you have no idea what she's talking about, and she doesn't like people and all this stuff. And still very nice, but, like, that's awesome. Like, that, to me, as a kid, would have been an awesome character, because they're just doing their own thing and are happy about it. But kind of the homogenizing force of gay culture was definitely something that I felt more when I, like, after I had my first, like, you know, sexual encounter with men and started going to gay bars, which was in the summer after my freshman year of college.
Where did you go for college?
I went to Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee.
Okay, what brought you there?
When I was looking for my college, the only thing that I was looking for was something that was not here. I wanted to get out. And so I went to look at all these colleges, and then we went to one of these colleges kind of in the Midwest or the Northeast. I think it was UChicago. In like April, which down here is like, hell yeah, shorts weather. But there was so cold. I was like, there's no way I cannot survive 4 years of this temperature. So on the way back from it, we stopped in Nashville and I had a tour there, and just loved it. Like, it had a lot of the things that I liked about being from the South, and was also like obviously a lot more open and progressive than my hometown was. Yeah.
What were you studying?
Musical arts, which was, my concentrations were operatic performance and composition.
Wow. Okay. That's pretty intense.
Yeah. Well, it was, you know, when I was thinking about this also the other day, it was like one of the few legitimate queer things I could do at a Christian school, which was singing, because the directors needed men, needed boys to play, and I was willing to do it. And so, you know, my first time singing, because I thought I was a bad musician. I had this this music teacher in fourth grade. So at my school, like in fourth grade, you move from the lower campus to the upper campus, and that's when you start taking either art or band or chorus or whatever. And so we had to do a musical assessment, and the teacher, you know, is like, match this pitch, you know, drum on this beat. And then afterwards, she recommended that I go into art instead. And so then I did art for like 3 years. And then the art teacher was like, hey, I know it, you know, next year's ninth grade year and the classes are smaller and I really need space for this one student who's got a lot of potential. So I'm recommending you to go to Chorus. And so I was like, no, I'm completely untalented. But from Chorus, the summer before that year, my family went on a trip to Europe and we stopped at Notre Dame. And there was a choir practicing there. And I remember to this day, the song, it was O Manu Mysterium, which is just a beautiful piece from the Renaissance. And in that space, it's like the most haunting thing ever. And so I was like, okay, maybe this singing thing might could be cool. And so I did Chorus. And then they were like, oh, you need to try out for the musical. And so I did. And I got the part of Horton in the Seussical, which was so fun. Mm-hmm. And I realized I'd always thought of myself as shy, but I realized I loved being on stage because the social rules are so very, very clear, which is all you people are going to sit there. I'm going to walk on the stage. I'm going to do something. You're going to clap and I'm going to leave. And then we're going to be done. Whereas like impromptu social situations, I always feel like, oh, where do I put my hands? So that was kind of how I got into music. And it just went from there.
What was the plan when you went to college? Were you like, and I'm going to be an opera singer?
When I went to college, I was going to do music and neuroscience. I was really interested in how those two things connect, particularly in animals and like how they think of acoustics. Because I'd been a huge marine biology nerd since I was a little kid. Like, I love fish and sea creatures. By the time I graduated, I had 5 fish tanks in my room. 2 saltwater, 2 freshwater, and a brackish water tank. So I thought I was going to go and do that. I got 2 weeks into calculus my freshman year. And it was right before the end of the add drop period. And the teacher said, come on, y'all, if you can't do this, you know, this is review. If you can't do this, you shouldn't be in the class. And I was like, bet. And so I peaced out, never looked back, and just did music for the rest of my time in undergrad.
Wow. Did you miss doing, or did you continue to do fish stuff, but more as a hobby?
It expanded more into just a love of like lots of different things. Like right now, for the last like 4 or 5 years, it's been all about plants. I'm just so into plants. You know, I did miss being able to have science classes, and I love science as a way of telling the story about the world. Mm-hmm. But I realized that if I wanted to do it, it would be many years of what I'd always consider busy work, of like doing the formula that they want you to do and doing this and doing this. And I'm just like so not interested in having to work on something that long to be able to get permission to do it. I just want to be able to do it. And with music, it's like, I mean, how do you become a better musician? By making music. And so it's, you have to do it all the time. And so, yeah, but I've been, one of the great things about my work now is that I get to work with lots of different people. And so, you know, we're designing some growing experiments with a local evolutionary biologist for our traditional Catawba corn variety. So I don't know, I get to still have some of that in my life, except without the calculus, which is such a blessing.
Yeah, I can only imagine. when you were you know what? Actually, something I wanted to ask you about. You mentioned that that was around the time you started going to like gay bars, and it sounds like finding other gay people. What was that experience like? Is it you're probably in a bigger, somewhat more cosmopolitan location?
So I was in Nashville, which is, I mean, if you've been in DC or Chicago or New York or San Francisco or any of those places, it's not a good city. But like coming from Rock Hill, South Carolina, where we have one gay bar, which I learned when I moved back, it's called The Hideaway. It's down a gravel road in a warehouse. And if you Google it, the first thing that comes up is local bar owner shoots man dead on New Year's Eve. So coming from that, it was like a paradise. But I did not actually, that was not actually my first experience with gay spaces. My first experience was after my freshman year when, so, you know, in a lot of other places you do internships during your summer, often voice students and music students will do like residency programs during the summer. So I did a program up in Vancouver for a month or two on like singing art song. And it was there that I met this beautiful French-Canadian pianist. And so we had a little fling, and that was fun. And he took me to some gay bars. And I was like, oh, cool. Like, yeah, this is it.
What do you remember from those bars?
It was some event, some big festival had just happened. This was like June or July. Oh, it was Fête de Musique. And so the gay bars were just like a hopping. I remember it was actually a predominantly lesbian bar, which is probably why I had a particularly nice first time, because most of the people there weren't interested in me. And so I wasn't like dealing with like a lot of attention or like people touching me, which I did experience when I went back to Nashville and went to the gay bar there for the first time. And I just remember going through the crowd and someone grabbing my butt and me turning around and being like, did you just touch my butt? Mm-hmm. And the guy, this older gentleman, was like, yeah, you're cute. And I was like, thank you, but why did you touch my butt? Like, I couldn't understand what was happening. And so, of course, afterwards I was chatting with my gal pals, and they were like, oh, a man touched you without your permission? Oh, it's so hard to imagine. So that was kind of my first experience in the United States of a gay bar.
Okay. How did you find it when you started going, like, I don't know, like more regularly? Like, did you have a regular place or were there regular people that you saw?
My job during college was singing for a church. Mm-hmm. And so we practiced on Wednesday nights, and that was college night at the gay bar. And so you had to get in before 11 to get the free ticket. And so basically I'd go and sing for Jeebus. And then at 9 o'clock was when the rehearsal ended. The lady who drove me was older, but thankfully drove very fast. So we got back to my dorm. I got back to my dorm room, and then I immediately was like having beers, doing shots, because of course I can't buy it at the bar. I even made this horrible drink that was a mix of passion fruit vodka and Franzia red wine, which will definitely get you drunk, but is also very gross. And so just getting sloshed and then getting ushered by the taxi cab, because Uber wasn't a thing at that time, over to the gay bar and trying to get in just under the wire. But it was a pretty fun drag scene, actually, because I think that's kind of a place that folks go to from all the other like southeastern areas to do drag.
Did you start to see more like, I guess, just options for the different ways of expressing queerness?
Yeah, absolutely. And I still just did not make friends with gay men, like, at all. Like, to this day, I think I have, I mean, I obviously have a lot of friends who are gay men, but, like a totally platonic gay relationship, I don't think I've ever had one of those until very, very recently. And so, still in my mind, men were not people to have relationships with. I still very much was, like, friends with the gals. And that's who I preferred to spend my time with.
Well, it sounds like it really matches the stuff that the ways that you like to play when you were a kid, and the entertainment and the media that you like to consume was very, powerful woman focused to generalize.
Oh, hell yeah. Hell yeah. Like, I love a powerful woman to this day. Like, hell, tell me what to do. Or actually, don't tell me what to do, because I'll immediately do the opposite, but like, let's come up with a plan.
Well, there's no characters like that in opera, so I'm sure.
Oh my gosh, I know. What a so sad to not be a soprano and to not be able to do the mad arias. Like, that was one of the reasons that I quickly fell out of love with opera, is because I'm a bass baritone, and so all of the roles are like, oh, it's the old man or the evil person, which can be fun, but they're not often evil in a super interesting way. Or like the buffoon. And it's like, that gets boring very fast. And also, like with sports, the opera world, the classical world, it's obviously changed a lot over the years and depends on who you talk to, but it's so focused on like very specific definitions of what success means. So, you know, in opera, for example, it's a vibrato that is consistent and vibrating throughout. And I'm just like more interested in the broadness of expression, particularly with my voice. And so, you know, I think sometimes moments call for something that's sotto voce, you know, that's not like loud and operatic. But of course, in my opera program, that would be grounds for an unsuccessful performance.
Yeah. So were you kind of over it by the time college was done?
Totally. Well, I think one thing that really put the nail in the coffin is that I could not practice. Like, I would have friends who would come out of the room after like an hour-long practice of singing, and they learned new songs. And meanwhile, I'm in there for like 15 minutes, and I'm like dragging myself out of the room. I'm so exhausted from it and like bored, and I can't focus. Flash forward to literally last month when I got an ADD diagnosis, and I'm like, oh, everything makes sense now. So the practicing thing is also just not like in my wheelhouse. And so I also like more improvisatory modes. But the thing that really kind of showed me a different way to be expressive on the stage was performance art. So we had John Cagepalooza my sophomore year, I believe. Are you familiar with John Cage?
I don't think so.
So he's a composer from the last 100 years, and he's famous for writing this piece, 4 minutes and 33 seconds, where the pianist walks on stage, opens the piano, and then just sits there in silence. Okay. 4 minutes and 33 seconds. And what he was trying to get people to listen to was like all the other sounds that are in the space, like people coughing and scooting their chairs or whatever. But we had a big celebration of his work. And one of the people that came to speak was a professor in the art department. And she, her area was performance art. And she was also from a tribe. And she was the only faculty member at the university who was from a tribal nation. She's Cayuga. Her name is Amelia Winger Bearskin. We're still like very close and buddies. But she did this amazing demonstration of some performance pieces that John Cage worked on. And one was where you all stand around in a circle with various sized bottles, and one person has a bottle full of water, and they're supposed to pour it into the person to their left's bottle, and then they pour it into the next person. And so, of course, all the water starts spilling out because it's very hard to keep it all in. And the piece is over once all there's no more water in the bottles. And mm-hmm. she does this on one of the stages that we use to perform on, which, you know, in opera is sacrosanct. So like, you don't eat on the stage, you don't drink on the stage. And here she is doing a piece that just is pouring water on the stage. And I was like, hell fucking yeah, fuck this shit up, let's do it. And so I took her performance art class the next semester. I did an independent study with her the following semester. And then she and I got a research, like a summer research thing to go up to New York for the summer, where I just got to do performance art, like just hang out and do art and watch art, and got to go to a lot of drag shows and like talk to some drag queens up there, which is really cool. Yeah,
that must have been like a real time of discovering stuff, like to spend some time in New York.
Oh, hell yeah. I mean, I realized I don't want to live there, but I loved it. Like, obviously, just so many beautiful men, but also so much art. Like, that's what was a little bit difficult about it, is that if you're doing art or performance art or anything in New York, you know, there is on any given night 10 different shows that are happening. And so you can be making work consistently, and it's hard to like get a you know, like a blip on the meter, I guess. So but it was amazing to be able to have that sort of support, and to be able to, because, you know, she was in charge of my project, and she was like, just do whatever the hell you want to do, like I don't care, which was awesome. So yeah, that's kind of how I transitioned out of opera and more into performance art.
Yeah, well, so tell me about some of your favorite things that you did or discovered, or, you know, either through your work or just exploring the city when you were new in New York.
Yeah. So let's see, what pieces did I do? I did this one piece called Snapping Turtle Wishing Well, and it was part of the Chashama performance art series. So basically they rent out or get permission from a bunch of different eclectic spaces around New York to do pieces in. Originally I was slated to be in Bryant Park, and then they moved me up to I can't remember the name of it now. It's just south of Harlem, in the like window next to this chicken processing building, which was interesting. Okay. But the piece, I made it because we have this story about where water comes from and how rabbit tricks snapping turtle into flooding the world and blah blah blah. But at the same time, that summer, tribes up in First Nations people up in Canada were advocating for their water rights, their treaty water rights. And so this piece I built a pond in this like window front and then stood there from sunrise to sunset with this umbrella that I rigged up to like pump water into it so that it was raining down on me, like doing the opposite of what an umbrella is supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And then I recited from memory this like indigenous, the statement on the universal indigenous rights to water. And it was definitely weird. And I literally lost all feeling in the skin on my right arm where the water was like beating down on me. But another piece that I think is probably still one of my favorite was, and you might have to bleep the name of this piece out. The name of the piece is, which is my phone number and still is to this day.
Oh.
And so what I did was I had this gallery space when I came back to Nashville to do a piece in. And so I wrote on the wall my phone number and then built this like 6-foot by 4-foot frame and then put a pedestal behind the frame and then put myself on the pedestal, which I love to do. And I had my cell phone in my hand and then all over the wall, I had suggestions like text me, you love me, text me, you hate me, text me about him, text me about her, you know, all these different kinds of invitations. And then my kind of script to myself was that one, I would respond to every message that I got. So it was up to the other person to end the conversation. And I would do that. I would sit at that pedestal for that entire evening, the kind of open house evening. And then I would do the responses through the end of the installation, which I think was a month. And it was just really interesting because I just heard so many narratives about techno-optimism and techno-pessimism, like technology will save us or technology will destroy us. And I think it's like anything else, it's going to be a mix of the two and it's going to be somewhere in between. Because what I found was like people were willing to tell me things that were really intimate. Like someone told me that their husband had just asked for a divorce and they hadn't told anyone else that yet. Someone else told me that they were cheating on someone. Several men sent me dick pics. But it was, you know, there's a level of intimacy that can come from communicating digitally, which I think as gay men, I think, or like just weirdos in general, I think we kind of get that. The funniest though was the older people who, I guess their favorite part of it was trying to goad me into talking to them. So I'm just sitting there on my pedestal texting, having these old people yelling at me. And I'm like, gosh, I hope someone gets a picture of this. Cause is this not what all of us like younger people experience? Older people yelling at us for texting.
Sure. That, I mean, what a project. What did you feel like you came away from New York? Like, did you, when that time was like wrapping up, were you like, all right, I know what I want to do, or that's given me a new direction at least to explore?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think for me, what I'm always most interested in is developing skills. And so what I loved about opera was that it taught me to be on stage. And I have no stage fright now. Like, it's very hard for me to have stage fright, which is such a useful skill. And I used to get crap from my family because they would say things like, Rue doesn't like people, he just likes audiences, which it's true. I mean, I love attention, I'll say it. But I also realized like a lot of people really don't want to have to be at the center of attention. And they do really appreciate it when someone just steps up and says, all right, everyone, welcome. This is what we're going to be doing today. You know, so, you know, that's what opera taught me. Performance art taught me really just the skill of looking at all of the available resources, right? Like in opera, you've got a piano and a voice and, you know, that's what you're supposed to be working with. Whereas with performance art, it's like, well, are you going to remove the walls? Are you going to put in new walls during the piece? Are you going to sit still for 5 years? Like what's all going to be involved? So it definitely gave me more skills and again, more confidence in performing.
What did you want to do like as college was wrapping up? Like, where did you think you were going
to
go?
Oh my gosh. I thought at first I was going to go to consulting, go into like big level consulting. Cause I was like, I want that money so that I can go and do other things. But then I got to like the level of interview where they start flying you in and like they meet, they show you around and introduce you to people and schmooze you. And I was like, just looking around and hearing about the work. And I was like, this sounds fucking miserable. I can't do this. So I abandoned that. Then I thought I would do Teach for America. And then I had very nice friends who explained to me why, one, it's not a good idea on the macro scale. And two, it's not a good idea for me personally. Mm-hmm. So after college, I did a quick fellowship program called Humanity in Action. So I got to go to Denmark where we learned about the history of the Holocaust in Denmark and how we can use that lens to understand the current moment. And it's been a great program. They've supported a lot of other projects of mine over the years. But then after that, I went home and I was like, okay, I'm going to go home and I'm going to start working for my community. But when I got home, I think it was still just too early in my like coming outness to be back home because I immediately felt so stifled. Like I had, like that there was no future, that there was nothing I could do, that I was stuck. And so I quickly found an AmeriCorps position, went and did that. They were terrible, so I quit. And then started teaching digital literacy for adults who are under, who are like below the third grade reading level, which was kind of tricky. But I also did theater and stuff while I was in DC. And then in 2017, I came back home.
You know, it sounds like a lot of the turns in your life have been moments when you were very honest about like, this just isn't for me. I don't like this. Either this is boring to me or I don't have the patience or this isn't where I just don't enjoy it. Which is something like, in talking to people about the choices that they've made in their life, sometimes it's hard for someone to be like, no, this is wrong. I don't know what it's right, but it's not this.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, and it's, well, we're taught not to, right? I mean, just the structure of the school system is made in such a way that we don't have any sort of sovereignty in how we spend our time or what we focus on, right? Several times I've been asked by different organizations in my tribe and local organizations and elsewhere to like give a talk with kids. And, you know, I'll always get at the end some question from an adult who's like, will you talk about the importance of homework and schoolwork? And then I go off on this whole like diatribe about how I don't think it's important. And I think it is a waste of time. And if people are telling you not to do something, but you feel like you should do it, you should fucking do it. Because it's just, I mean, it is such an atrocity what we're doing with kids in schools. And it's so contrary to what kids actually need. So yeah, I'm really appreciative that I did have parents and a family that for the most part would put up with that. Although we did have tension about school because, again, now that I have ADD, now that I have a diagnosis, I'm like, oh, well, I couldn't do the things that I thought were busy work because they weren't interesting. And it's that's me to this day. When something becomes boring, I have to transition to something else because I don't know. I can't force myself to do it.
Yeah, it really is one of those, certainly not the only one, but invisible differences that makes it really hard to, you know, understand the accommodations that work best for you. I say this as someone who also got an ADD diagnosis this year. You know, it really makes you revisit the things that you were like, boy, why did I fail at that? And you realize, oh no, that thing failed me.
Yes, absolutely. It absolutely. And what is wild to me is now as an educator, and of course I have the benefit of my experience, but like when I am looking at kids and I'm just thinking about like what I would have looked like to a teacher at the time. And what I would have looked like is a kid who was deeply interested in sea life and was reading like fourth, fifth, sixth grade reading like level books about sea life because that's what he was interested in. Why the hell wouldn't you just let the kid do that? You know, right? Like, why wouldn't like, instead of like, no, we gotta diagram these sentences. And I just remember being like, this is never going to be important in my life. And I was right. Me and my therapist are working a lot on me, like talking to, you know, whatever kid Rue and being like, you were right. Like when you played with dolls and people said, that's not what boys do. You were right. When someone said, no, it's really important for you to diagram the sentence. And you said it wasn't, you were right. Because we're told we're not right so often.
Yeah. So when you came home and you were feeling really stifled, you knew like this isn't where you want it to be. You started reaching out to AmeriCorps and teaching stuff. Did you start to find stuff that did feel right to you? And I just give yourself permission to do the thing that felt right.
I think what I realized in DC when I was able to go to DC was that the only thing that feels right is having something that is having lots of different things. And that's true today. Like I do grant writing for my tribe. I do language work for my tribe, food sovereignty work for my tribe. I have an artistic career outside of it, you know, just lots of different things because much as polyamory talks about how, you know, it might not, one person might not be enough for one other person. I don't think any one job or task is enough for my attention span. So that's something I learned from DC. But the reason I think I also like had this desire to do something big, you know, like really the feeling that the song I Can Go the Distance and Hercules gives you of like the future is big. And so I wanted to be in a place where I thought big things happen, which at the time I thought was DC and realized, no, that's not where big things happen. That's where big things go to die. And so that was, you know, particularly right after Trump got elected, I was like, I got to get the hell out of here. Mm-hmm. And so I was very lucky to receive a grant to get out of there. But it was also interesting that time around the election, because, of course, DC is incredibly blue, like overwhelmingly voted against Trump. But I got a grant to do a performance piece that was tours of the Presidential Portrait Gallery, mm-hmm. Talking about how each one interacted with Indigenous people, because for the most part, the only thing that people know about presidents and tribes is Andrew Jackson. But the reality is that every president has had to deal with tribes as a matter of federal policy. And so it was really interesting doing that, because I did it for 2 months leading up to the election. And mm-hmm. then that night, Rudy Giuliani, the night that Trump won, Rudy Giuliani said that this is the greatest victory for average Americans since the election of Andrew Jackson. And then he repeated it on a different show and then repeated it the next day. And I was like, damn, I have to keep doing this. But it was interesting at inauguration week because there were so many non-DC people there, mm-hmm. Presumably Trump supporters who were from out of town. Mm-hmm. And so it was very interesting to get their responses to the tour. It was also interesting to see them at the inauguration, because I participated in the queer blockade, where we basically just did a big old queer dance party at 5 a.m. outside of one of the entrances to the inauguration, which, highly, you know, when a fascist is coming into office, I highly recommend that as the way to kick it off.
Must have been a challenging atmosphere, like in D.C. around that time. Like,
yeah.
I was there for work purposes, never very long during the Obama years. And, you know, there's, I guess, kind of a comfort knowing like your people, or at least someone who's a little bit more sympathetic to your people, are in power, mm-hmm. Versus the people who just, it feels like, hate everything about me are the ones who are calling the shots right now.
And that's one of the things about DC. And I also want to make sure to, you know, separate the people of DC, Washingtonians, right? And who mm-hmm. are predominantly Black, predominantly not white, who have lived there for many generations. Then there's this whole other class, of which I for sure would have been a part of, which is the kind of transitory class that moves through for, I mean, often it's tied to administrations, right? And so that's what you really saw in DC as the Trump administration was coming in, was just like all of these apartments going up for sale or for rent, and lots of people moving out of town and lots of new people moving into town. And it's a weird city in that way. But the other thing that I found really off-putting about DC was actually the gay community there. Mm-hmm. Because people were like, oh, you know, DC is one of the queerest places in the country. Like, you get to go and there's so many gay people there. And I was like, great, let's do it. But what I experienced was like a lot of very anti-Native sentiment from the gay folks. Like, I remember at a drag show, there was some queen who was wearing a headdress, right? A war bonnet. And so I was like, oh, I'm going to go and talk to them. And then the people that I was there with was like, well, don't go and bother her. And I was like, what do you mean? Like, she's culturally appropriating. And then they were like, why do you care? And I explained I was Catawba. And they were like, okay, Pocahontas. And I'm like, what is going on? What is going on here?
Well, I'm certainly aware that there is a... The DC gay culture visibly can be extremely white, and that there is a shamelessness to the racism that is often pretty shocking.
Yeah. Another example. So in 2000, maybe it was 17. I remember I was living down here and had to go up for it. It was DC Pride, which is one of these very, 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 very corporate prides. Yeah. And so
Halliburton in the parade. And,
oh, my God. Yeah. Yes. Oh, my gosh. Lockheed Martin. Mm-hmm. There was a freaking float this year that had three like models, scale models of death machines on the mm-hmm. float, like this death airplane, this death tank, and this death ship in a pride parade. I'm like, what is happening? Yeah. So some Indigenous folks up there and some Black Lives Matter organizers and some disability folks and lots of other folks came together to do a to do a disruption of Pride that year. And so we had like several blockade points. And so I was part of the Indigenous blockade. And so each of us blockaded a different float. I believe the Black Lives Matter blockaded the police float that was in it. Mm-hmm. We blockaded the Wells Fargo float because they're one of the greatest funders of oil drilling and disposition right, of indigenous lands.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so we're there, we're locked down, we've got our arms and PVC pipes, we're making chants, and one of the chants is there's no pride in genocide. And then one of these older white gay men comes up and is trying to like kick the PVC pipe. And I know for a fact this man lives in a rich part of DC. I know he has an expensive house. He comes and tries to kick the PVC pipe with our hands in it, and it starts trying to chant like, I don't care about genocide or something. And I'm like, what? What? Like, I thought we could all just kind of be on the same page that genocide is bad.
I mean, and beyond that, on the same page about like what fucking pride is for.
Right. And he was so mad that the parade couldn't move on. And I'm like, first off, why are you so invested in this parade? This parade of corporate floats. Like, why do you care?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, the answer is because he probably works in PR for one of these companies, but, you know, setting
Matt with coming with the tea.
Honestly, you know, I've been in that world and I know how it is that they're like, oh fuck, Raytheon's going to be mad at me because we didn't let their fight go through.
Raytheon's going to be so pissed.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, honestly, like that's the best way to celebrate pride is with a disruptive riot.
Yes. And, okay. Oh, I have to tell you this before we end, because I know we're getting at the end of the time, but my first pride. Mm-hmm. Oh, Matt, my first pride. It was in Berlin.
And it was, that's the place to go.
Amazing. It was just like everything I could ever want. Maybe there are a few businesses, but they were all like local bars and like drag venues and BDSM clubs and all that stuff. And there's like full nudity and sexual acts happening. At the same time, there's just families with kids mm-hmm. and strollers, just, you know, heterosexual families just walking along. And it was just, oh, it was so lovely and so safe. And the whole city was having a party. It was, so I think that's part of my bitterness at the DC Pride, because that was the next Pride I went to.
Mm-hmm. Oof. Yeah, that is quite a shift. I often think that you can, you know, measure the climate of a city. Like it says a lot about a city, mm-hmm. whether the pride has barriers on it or not. My experience of Berlin Pride is that it's a very like, just walk right in, walk along with the parade, come in, come out, yes. do what you want.
And I kept like asking the people next to me, I was like, Entschuldigen Sie bitte, can I like walk in? Can I just walk? And they were like, mm-hmm. yeah, you can just walk. And I kept asking people because I was like, there's no way. Like, there's no way I could just. And then I just started walking. And then this very handsome Israeli man was like, you're very pale. And I was like, thank you. And he was like, do you want to go have sex in those bushes? And I was like, no, thank you. But you can take me to your apartment. And then we had a 3-week torrid love affair that ended when he broke up with me inside of a big top. After we had sex next to a lion.
Oh my gosh. I mean,
but that's a story for another time.
that's so cinematic. So yeah, I can see how that like would set some expectations that the DC Pride might let you down on.
Yes, they didn't quite fulfill those expectations of mine.
So tell me about the work that you do now, the works that you do now. Like, how did you move from, you know, doing these like portrait gallery tours and all that kind of stuff to being back in, you're in the town. Is it correct that you're in the town or near the town where you grew up?
Yeah, I'm in. So it's kind of wonky because I'm on the reservation. Mm-hmm. The city of Rock Hill considers us part of Rock Hill. I don't consider us a part of Rock Hill, but I grew up in Rock Hill. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm right where I grew up. I know all the roads that I grew up around. So I got to come back thanks to a grant from this organization called Running Strong for American Indian Youth. Mm-hmm. And every year they give out 10 grants to 10 Native youth from across the country. I no longer qualify as a youth under their definition. Mm-hmm. But at the time I did, and each one they gets $10,000 to pursue a dream for their community. And so mine was around creating digital, like creating an app for our language. And I had like a little bit of like HTML and CSS experience from like MySpace days. Mm-hmm. But they were like, do you have this, are you going to be able to like code this website? And I was like, oh yeah, totally. Sure. So then I had like a year of like frantically learning how to code and making kind of a dinky website. But since then we've had new versions and they're getting better and better. We have a really exciting one coming up in this year, but, that's kind of how I got back here. And then once I got back here, it was just a process of like, I kept hearing of interesting things and I wanted to work on them, like food sovereignty. I also like my tribe is known for our pottery. It's our oldest unbroken tradition. We've been doing pottery for at least 6,000 years. But I am not a potter. I'm a basket maker. And so, you know, I think of that as a metaphor for a lot of the work that I do, which is not necessarily doing anything new, but rather weaving things together. Because when I came here and started getting interested in food sovereignty, which is, it's like food security, but instead communities have control over also how the food is produced and what kind of food is produced. So that's what we're advocating for. But there was already so many people working on that, like our cultural center, our wellness department, our clinic. And so all I really did, you know, with the help of all those people was just say, hey, let's start having meetings and talking to each other. So that tends to be like where my work lies for my tribe, which is like trying to weave things together, trying to make them resilient, trying to connect funders with our awesome work. But I still do art and stuff outside of my tribe. This year I'm an iBeam fellow for the iBeam gallery up in New York. And so me and the other fellows are looking at how we can restructure how artist funding work so that it actually gets to artists faster and has less bureaucratic oversights and things like that. So I don't know. It's just, again, it's kind of like whatever catches my interest is probably what I'm going to be working on.
I mean, this does sound like a sort of a dream position for somebody who's chasing the neurotransmitters in a way that is very specific.
Yes.
As I say on my podcast, that is also a companion podcast to a video series that is also part of my day job. That is also part
yes, exactly. Well, yeah. I mean, what's the point if we're not doing what's interesting to us? Like, I've just never. I mean, it is interesting to me when I meet people who are like, "No, I just want to go to work and know that I'm done and just go home." And I'm like, "Oh, that's so cool. It's so different from me because I would die. I just couldn't do it at all."
Of the stuff that you're doing now, like, is there are there projects that stand out as like the ones that you're particularly proud of or had a great time on, or like just you really want everybody to see?
A project that I'm really proud of is what we're doing with our Catawba corn. So this is our only traditional seed variety that we have. We lost it in the 90s, and thanks to some amazing folks, we were able to relocate it. But it's just this incredible corn that grows in almost any soil. It needs almost no watering, which is both of those things, fertilizer and water, are two of the most expensive resources in growing corn in the United States. Mm-hmm. And so just like marveling at the brilliance of this corn and our ancestors to select for drought resistant corn. But also, this is like the drag queen of corn. Like, there's thousands of colors and pattern variations on it. And so this year, we're going to be doing a lot of work with growing it and processing it into food. And so that's, at this very moment, that's what I'm most excited about.
Now, that's to help people visualize it, like, it's like a rainbow of colors, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like black to pure white to yellow to like pink with yellow stripes to red to blue, like just all sorts of colors.
Yeah. I grew up in Connecticut, and there was some limited amount of native culture that we were exposed to in the school system there. And, you know, again, like I remember those like moments when I was like, oh, you mean it's not all like the stuff at the supermarket?
Right. And that was one of the issues that we're having, which is that it's not a sweet corn, which is what most Americans are used to. It's a flour corn, which you have to process differently. And so the first year we grew it, some people grabbed the corn and then tried to cook it like sweet corn.
Right.
And we're like, this is horrible. And I was like, yeah, because you didn't prepare it correctly. But yeah.
So if people want to check out that work and the pottery and all the other stuff that you're doing, where should they go?
You can find me anywhere online with my legal first name, my government name, DELESSLAN. That's Deleslin. That's my first name, Deleslin. And you can find Catawba Nation at catawbaculture.org.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for joining me.
Hello, Matt. It was wonderful.
Thanks to Rue for joining me, and thanks to you for listening. And thanks to everybody who makes The Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to support the show and get backer rewards like stickers in the mail and exclusive bonus videos. Check out my YouTube for deep dives into pop culture history at youtube.com/mattbaum and my newsletter at mattbaum.com. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.